the young woman called Liz. "It's Bussy, ma'am, Jefferson Davis Bussy." Seeing Lucy's eyes go bright with surprise, Jeff told them how his father had fought with a Confederate president at Buena Vista 17 years earlier. Mrs. Washburn gave a little gasp of motherly solicitude.
"Your cheek is bleeding. Won't you let me dress it for you?"
She spoke gently. Her voice was low and melodious, like Lucy's.
"And you've ripped 2 buttons off your coat," Liz added. "While Mother fixes up your cheek, Lucy can sew on your buttons. She sews better than anybody else in the family."
Lucy colored and looked provoked, but she went obediently into the house, and Jeff guessed she had gone after her needle and thread. At the front porch, there was a moment of awkward hesitation. The 3 older women looked uncertainly at one another, as though debating the propriety of asking an enemy soldier into their home. Then Mrs. Washburn laughed, a low, musical laugh.
"Won't you come in, Mr. Bussy?" she invited pleasantly. "We won't let Lucy bite you. Naturally, we all feel pretty strongly about the war. My husband and also the husbands of my 2 daughters here are all in the Cherokee Mounted Rifles with Colonel Wadey. So is my son, Lee."
She spoke slowly and deliberately, selecting her words with care. Jeff liked her. He liked her honesty, too. He said,
"Thank you, ma'am."
He followed them inside the house, seeing again the rich carpet on the floors, the paneled walls, the glow of china. He thought of his own modest log home back in Linn County, and wished that this home wasn't so big and elegant and tastefully furnished. Mrs. Washburn seated him on a stool in the kitchen while she washed his cut with soap and water and dressed it with arnica salve. Then she led him to the parlor. "Lucy," skirts rustling, entered the room with her sewing basket. There was a tiny silver thimble on her middle finger. Immediately, Jeff felt the tension between them. Without speaking, he took off his blue coat and handed it to her. As his fingers touched hers, a shiver of pleasure shot up his arm. He looked at her, but she sat down silently on a settee. He sank uninvited into a chair opposite her. The other women went about their tasks in other parts of the house. While she was busy selecting her thread, the large white Persian cat padded in silently and rubbed against Jeff's legs. He reached down and stroked its back.
"Where's your dog, Mr. Bussy?"
Lucy asked with a cool politeness that Jeff found maddening. She peered at him over the needle's eye and then threaded it swiftly.
"Ma'am, I tied her to a tent pole back in camp. I didn't want her to fight your cat."
The corners of Lucy's small oval mouth seemed to want to turn upward in a smile, but with an effort, she stifled it. She said primly,
"I believe you told me last summer that she was a Confederate dog."
"That's right, ma'am," said Jeff, and he told her about finding Dixie at Wilson's Creek. Although she tried not to show it, he knew she was listening carefully. Lucy held up his blue coat. A shaft of late afternoon sunshine struck the cloth, and the dark blue suddenly became lighter. An expression of strong emotion crossed the girl's face, as though the coat had aroused some unpleasant memory.
"I have no union buttons," she said, staring coldly at him. "All I have are some leftover buttons off my father's 1st uniform coat. Would wearing Southern buttons violate your Northern scruples, Mr. Bussy?"
Jeff said gently,
"Ma'am, they'll do fine. I'll gladly wear them."
He felt vaguely uneasy. She looked as if she wanted to quarrel. With a quick, deft motion of her right hand, Lucy knotted the end of the light blue thread and looked at him with thinly veiled hostility.
"Why do you make war on us?" she asked, looking him squarely in the eye.
Jeff was taken aback by her directness. Then he felt a strange relief. At last, some of the trouble between them was out in the open. Maybe at least she'd talk. He took his time, feeling his way carefully and trying to stay calm.
"Ma'am, I think we make war upon the South for the sole purpose of restoring it to the Union. I know slavery's involved, too, but President Lincoln made it plain before he was ever elected that he didn't want to interfere with slavery where it now exists.
She bit the thread off with her small, sharp teeth.
But why won't Lincoln let the South have slavery in the new Western Territory? After all, we helped win that country in the Mexican War. What's right about that? Why shouldn't the territories themselves decide what they want to do about slavery?
Because, ma'am, the Declaration of Independence itself forbids slavery, and the Declaration is what we're supposed to live by in this country.
Not in my country, she corrected him. You're not in the United States now, Mr. Bussey. You're in the Cherokee Indian Nation. We have our own system of government here, and you are bound by treaty to respect it. And anyway, what in your Declaration of Independence or your Constitution prohibits slavery?
Warming to the argument, Jeff sat up straighter. He was sure of his ground here.
Ma'am, the Declaration says that all men, and that includes Negroes as well as whites, are created equal. It says that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It doesn't say, ma'am, that just the rich man, or the white man, or the Anglo-Saxon white man, or the Kansas white man is entitled to liberty. It says all men. Ma'am, no man or woman in slavery has any liberty.
Jeff saw her wince and a small shadow of doubt cross her eyes.
But it doesn't specifically say we can't have slavery, she argued stiffly. There was slave trade in both North and South when your Declaration of Independence was written, and ever since it was written, slavery has existed and Congress hasn't tried to stop it. Can you quote me anything from it that comes right out and says that slavery shall not exist?
No, ma'am, acknowledged Jeff truthfully. Not in the final draft. But did you know, ma'am, that in the original draft, the slave trade was called an execrable commerce, a piratical warfare, and a cruel war against human nature? Jeff had no trouble quoting the words accurately. He had heard his father repeat them scores of times. They were clearly engraved upon his memory, as though etched there by needles of fire. It was obvious Lucy hadn't known. Flushing, she looked at him with surprise. She hadn't dreamed this boyish Union private would be so singularly well-informed.
Then why was it left out of the final draft?
Because, ma'am, Jeff explained patiently, two states disagreed. They were Georgia and South Carolina. All the other states, both North and South, agreed. But in order to preserve harmony, the expressions were omitted from the final draft. However, it showed what most of the country, even most of the South, thought about slavery. And that's why President Lincoln didn't want to see slavery started in the new territories. Lucy abandoned her arguments concerning the American Constitution. She thrust the needle through the underside of the coat and, threading one of the brass Confederate buttons through it, began vigorously to stitch it to the material. Passionately, she said,
"Slavery and preservation of the Union has very little to do with the Cherokee Indian Nation. Your country took our homes and our land away from us once, back in Georgia and Alabama, and now you're getting ready to do it again. Is it any wonder we don't like the United States and that we made a treaty with the Confederacy?"
Jeff remembered Joe Grayson, the Cherokee boy, telling how his mother had lost her home in Georgia.
"What do you mean, ma'am, that my country is getting ready to do it again? Jackson was a Democrat. My government is Republican."
She bit her lower lip.
"That doesn't change anything. During the 1860 campaign, Seward, your leading Republican, wanted to seize our lands and fill them with white settlers. For years, the people of Kansas have wanted to get rid of their Indian tribes. Where do you think they'd send them? To Nebraska? Or Missouri? Or Colorado? They'd send them to our country and force us to give or sell them cheaply our lands here. So why should we remain loyal to you? Besides, your government deserted us when the war started.
It's true, ma'am, Jeff admitted, that we had to take out our soldiers to keep them from being captured. We weren't prepared for war. We weren't planning a war. The South was. They were organizing home militia and making treaties with the Indians.
Lucy lifted her chin proudly.
And it was the finest treaty we ever got. We can partition or sell our surplus lands. We can sell our personal property. We can move out intruders whenever we wish, and the Confederate Army will help us. No agent can be assigned to us without our consent. Funds that the United States owes us and won't pay us will be paid in full by the Confederacy. We have been given our own judicial district, just like any Confederate state. We are allowed our own delegate to the Confederate Congress. All these things have been denied us by your United States government.
She had almost finished stitching on the last button. Her fingers began to tremble. Jeff's lips compressed. Now she had him going. What a stupid war it was. To him, the issues seemed all mixed up. Each state in the Union seemed to have a different reason for fighting. In Kansas, it was the Free State Party versus the pro-slavery people. In Missouri, the Union faction, living in the southern part of the state, was fighting the rebels, living to the north. In the Cherokee Indian Nation, it was the Stand Watie Cherokees fighting the John Ross Cherokees over the old removal bitterness, and slavery seemed very little involved. In fact, he had heard that John Ross, leader of the Northern Cherokees, owned 100 Negro slaves and apparently was satisfied with the custom. And in all the states and territories, gangs of bushwhackers who didn't know what they were fighting for roamed and pillaged the war-torn country, defying both the Union and rebel armies.
Ma'am, I had no idea all this had happened. It does seem that my government has treated your country badly, but...
Jeff saw that she had grown suddenly pale. Her lips parted as to speak. She took a long, tremulous breath. She said,
"What do you mean, it seems so? You raid our country, rob us of our valuables, despoil our property. Your officers are insolent and make us cook for them. Your soldiers, like those this afternoon, insult us. If my father or my brother wants to see us, they have to slip across the river like thieves in the night and risk being captured or shot."
Her low voice, vibrant with passion, failed. She began to sew faster than ever. Jeff didn't dare speak. Tears welled into her eyes. Suddenly she flinched and gave a little gasp of pain. A tiny spot of blood appeared on her finger. She had accidentally stuck it with a needle. Throwing his coat upon the floor, she ran, weeping, from the room. Shaken, Jeff stood, looking after her in wonder and pain. Finally, he stooped and picked up his coat. Clumsily, he broke the remaining thread off the second button, noticing it was sewn on strongly and neatly. He thrust Lucy's needle into the padded top of her sewing basket where she could find it, and stood indecisively.
Corn! He'd never seen such a peculiar, independent girl. Always foamed up about the war. In any war, there were robbing and killing and despoiling by both sides. Surely she knew that.
Sighing, he shook his head helplessly. He had wanted to comfort her, but his courage had failed him. Resignedly, he drew a long breath and looked resentfully around the room with its elegantly upholstered furniture and its large Bible bound in blue leather with the name Levi Washburn engraved proudly on it in silver letters. He felt miserable. He guessed he was head over heels in love with Lucy, but he might just as well be in love with some girl living on a star. The only thing they had in common was the war, and they were hopelessly crossed on that.
Why had he been so foolish as to fall for a rebel girl?
He put on his coat and buttoned it. Lucy did know a lot about politics,
He had learned more in the last 5 minutes about the Cherokee Indian Nation than he had ever dreamed existed. He hadn't realized the Cherokees had a small republic of their own within the United States. He had picked up his cap and turned to go when Mrs. Adair came into the room.
"Where's Lucy?"
she asked, surprised. Sheepishly, Jeff shook his head.
"We were arguing about the war, ma'am, when she stuck her finger with the needle. She began crying and ran from the room."
Mrs. Adair stared at him thoughtfully, her hands clenched tightly in front of her. Jeff could tell she felt sorry for him. He guessed she could tell by his face how smitten he was on Lucy. But there was something else in her face, too, something that bordered on fear. Lucy's sister seemed to be hesitating, as though weighing something carefully in her mind. She said impulsively,
"Mr. Bussey, even though you are in the Union Army, I feel that I can trust you, and that some explanation of Lucy's conduct is due you. We're all worried frantic about our brother Lee. We haven't told Mother yet, but he's been missing 2 weeks after being out on scout. Lucy especially has been prostrate with worry and fear. She and her brother are very close. She has a horror of Lee or Father being killed. That's why she can never talk rationally about the war."
Jeff swallowed hard. No wonder Lucy hated the sight of a blue uniform. He'd never be able to make her like him so long as the war lasted, and it would probably last a long time. He turned glumly toward the door, cap in hand.
"Ma'am, please tell her that I'm grateful to her for sewing on my buttons. Her father's buttons. And that I'm sorry we have to fight against her brother and her father. And I hope her brother gets back safely from a scout."
Mrs. Adair nodded. Tears came to her eyes, but her voice was steady.
"Thank you. I'll tell her."
As Jeff walked up the road, he wished he could help the Washburns find Lee. But how would you go about trying to find an enemy missing on scout? The Union couldn't even keep track of its own men missing on scout. Chapter 15. Fate of the Brands. A week later, Jeff was standing at dusk near the north gate of Fort Gibson when he heard wagon wheels rumbling and hundreds of slow hoofbeats. His heart leaped hopefully. Maybe it was a food train. Forage and provisions were running low. With Wadey raiding so widely, no corn had been raised in the Cherokee country. The fort was wholly dependent now upon the food freighted overland by mule train from far-off Kansas, and upon small acquisitions of flour and meal ground at Hildebrand's mill on Flint Creek from corn and wheat, secured by stealthy dashes into nearby Arkansas. Weeks had passed since a supply train had come from Fort Scott. Everybody was tired of the weevily meat and the quarter rations of salt horse. Besides, 10,000 rebels stationed along the south bank of the Arkansas River, from Weber's Falls to the north of the Grand, were poised for an attack. The fort's plight had become desperate. Jeff kicked at a small rock embedded in the ground. Federal blunders and indifference had done it. Located hundreds of miles west of the main theater of war, the fort had been virtually abandoned by Union authorities at St. Louis. A double column of dusty figures rode horseback through the fort's great wooden gate. Their black campaign hats and their blue shoulders bobbed over the top of the fort's sharply pointed, close-set log palisades. As they drew closer, Jeff saw they were cavalry. Their faces were raw and swollen from the stings of horseflies and the scratches of tree branches striking them as they traveled through the woods. They looked as though they had been choking in their own dust all the way from Kansas. Disappointed, he walked out to meet them, hoping they were escorting at least part of a food train. But only their own baggage wagons followed, and when he saw how easily the tired mules pulled the wagons, he knew they were loaded only lightly. When he tried to question them about where they had come from and how the war was going in the East, they stared at him and never spoke. Unabashed, he walked with them as they rode past the new stone supply buildings covered with slate that Colonel Phillips had ordered constructed atop the bluff overlooking Grand River. Moving on to the lowlands, they halted near the site of the original fort, now two decaying blockhouses. There they dismounted slowly, and once on the ground, staggered unsteadily and stomped their feet to restore the circulation. With their hands, they beat clouds of dust off their pants and blouses. Some of them hawked deeply and noisily, spat the dust from their throats. Others gave gruff commands to their horses and clomped about in their boots, their brass spurs jingling as they began to set up camp. Despite their lack of hospitality, Jeff was impressed with the careful way they attended to their horses before they ate a bite of supper themselves. They removed the saddles, permitting the animals to roll on the ground. They shook out the brown saddle blankets and began to groom the horses briskly. Standing well away and leaning hard on the curry combs and brushes, they wiped the dry mud and the scurf from the horse's skin. Then they hand-rubbed the horse's legs and sponged out their nostrils and docks. Only after they had cared for their mounts and fed them hay and grain did the weary men unbuckle their saber belts and head gratefully for the mess halls at the top of the bluff.
"Jeff!"
One of the cavalrymen, trudging up the rise, left the column and ran awkwardly in his boots toward Jeff. Jeff didn't recognize the husky young fellow with orange freckles all over his face, who grasped his hand in both of his. On the front of his soiled black felt hat was a brass insignia of swords crossed. He wore low reddish sideburns, and his eyebrows were heavy and white as corn silk.
"Gosh almighty, Jeff, don't you know me? I'm David Gardner."
A glad grin spread over Jeff's face.
"David,"
he blurted. He couldn't get over how David had grown.
"Where'd you come from?"
David spat a big chew of tobacco into one of his freckled hands and hurled it onto the ground behind him. He was grinning happily, too.
"From Fort Scott."
"When's the next supply train coming out?"
David pointed back up the road.
"It's only about 2 or 3 days behind us."
"Been home lately?"
David shook his head.
"Not since that morning you caught Ma and me jawing in the yard."
He looked thoughtfully at the ground.
"I expect Ma's had a hard time the last 2 years."
"You haven't heard word from any of my folks, have you?"
Jeff asked hopefully. David took off his hat. He whipped it across his knee and the trail dust flew.
"No, I met a conscript from Sugar Mound several months ago when I was on the ditch crew at Rolla. He told me they'd had plenty of rain back home the last 2 years. Finally busted the drought. No more deserting for me, Jeff. I worked out my punishment. Now I'm reinstated. You and Ma was right."
David's voice was deeper, and there was an air of assurance and competency about him. He didn't look anything like the lonely, scrawny, homesick fella Jeff had known back at Fort Leavenworth. David's glance shifted back to the horses, his forehead wrinkled in surprise.
"Hey,
what's she doing that for, Jeff?"
A thin-faced Indian girl carrying an empty pan glided up where the newly arrived horses were eating and began timidly to pick up from the ground the grains of corn dropping from the horses' mouths.
"She's hungry," Jeff explained. "She'll take the corn home and wash it, then they'll parch it and eat it. We've got more than 6,000 Indian refugees here, mostly women and children, lying under trees, most of them sick and half-starved. They had to come to the fort for protection. The whole country's thick with rebels and bushwhackers robbing and killing people."
David began to fan himself thoughtfully with his hat.
"I didn't know things was that bad. Let's go up to the fort, Jeff, and get some drinking water. I'm drier than a cork leg."
"How'd you get in the cavalry?"
Jeff asked as they walked along.
"They're converting lots of infantry into cavalry at Fort Scott now," David said. "We brought several cavalry instructors out with us. One of them is Lieutenant Foss. You ought to see that fella ride, Jeff. He sits up there as easy as a hoss fly on a mule's ear. They're going to convert lots of your infantry here into cavalry, too. How'd you like that, Jeff?"
"Corn, David, I'd like it."
Jeff had always wanted to be in the cavalry. Only, I still don't have a horse. David scoffed.
Gosh almighty, Jeff, that won't keep you out no more. We got horses to burn now. The supply train escort is bringing 1,000 head down with them. It's men the cavalry needs now, not horses. We hear they're going to start training you in a week.
Instead, they started in 3 days. Jeff enjoyed the look of surprise on Noah's somber face when he told him about it at breakfast the full day before it was announced at the fort. Noah frowned, stirring his coffee.
I'd rather stay on the ground. Riding a horse makes my head spin and my feet hurt. But it's a wise move. Cavalry is more important out here in the west than it is back east. Here the distances are greater, and the rival army's smaller. If a blow needs to be struck here, it might take the infantry several days to walk to where it's going, but cavalry could get there in a few hours. Wonder where they're going to train us.
The training began on the fort's drill ground located on the open prairie to the west. Despite the unfamiliar routine of the cavalry drills, Jeff liked the change. Back home, he had ridden horses almost before he had learned to walk, so he had no trouble managing the big, slow sorrel checked out to him. He discovered that the animal, which had belonged to a cavalryman who had died of dysentery, could teach him more than any of the drill masters, and without cursing him, too. When the bugles blew right about and left about, the sorrel knew instinctively what to do and when to do it. He was smarter than any sergeant on the premises. But not even the horse could help him when they were introduced to the saber drills. Jeff didn't like the short, curved cavalry sword known as the saber. In the first place, he couldn't walk wearing one without it barking his legs or tripping him up. On a horse, it was even worse. When he was commanded to draw and brandish it while galloping, it became positively dangerous. He did pretty well with the commands, right cut against infantry and left cut against infantry, but when ordered to execute the rear moulinet, he quickly came to grief. At the first pass of the saber behind his back, Jeff slashed a long gash in his new oilskin slicker rolled up on the rear of his saddle. Later, he was reminded of it every time it rained, and cold water rushed through the rent and down his back. And when the command was front moulinet, he whipped his blade so near the sorrel's ear that the horse lurched in fright, and he was almost unseated.
"Do it like this!"
bellowed Lieutenant Foss, a tall, leather-faced Coloradoan, bow-legged as a hoop. He was in charge of the drill and skillfully performed the various passes.
"Corn!" Jeff marveled to Stuart Mitchell, riding nearby. "He makes that old cheese knife spin like a circular saw."
But the lieutenant was the only man in the outfit who could come even remotely close to doing the saber cuts correctly. Jeff decided that if he ever got into a cavalry battle, he would forget about the saber and try to get in all his licks with his one-shot Sharp's carbine or his pepper pot, as he called the big cap-and-ball pistol he was given to wear in his belt. When he looked over his shoulder at Noah, astride a hard-mouthed bay, Jeff straightaway forgot his own troubles amid the hilarity of watching another's. Noah was obviously no Cossack. His face turned a chalk white when he first mounted the bay. Panic in his face, he dropped his shiny saber in the green prairie grass and lost one of his bridle reins, too. His infantry cap, not much bigger than a postage stamp, had fallen forward over his eyes. His mount was trotting roughly, and every time Noah's gaunt body came down, it bounced so high in the saddle that Jeff could see a foot of daylight under the seat of his pants.
"Circle your leaders and keep up the drags!" a former cowboy in the company yelled, giving Noah's awkward effort the flavor of a cattle stampede.
Noah's big feet escaped the stirrups, and his long legs, swinging comically far below the bay's belly, began to churn so violently up and down the sides of the horse that his blue trousers were pushed up high, exposing the legs of his long red underwear. Jeff rode out and caught the horse by the bridle until Noah, cursing beneath his breath, could recover his lost rein, pull down his pant legs, and thrust his feet back into the stirrups. The new cavalry was quickly pressed into service despite its greenness. The guerrilla warfare that summer of '63 was increasing in savagery every day. The position of Fort Gibson was critical. When Colonel Phillips sent 800 cavalry up the Texas Road as an escort to the first federal supply train that had come through in months, the rebels boldly crossed the Arkansas River and captured more than 1,000 Union horses and mules. General Douglas Cooper's rebels were now camped so close that every night Jeff could see the rebel campfires across the river. Groups of Wade's rebel Cherokee horsemen made raid after raid behind the Union lines in the vicinity of Spavinaw and Grand River, destroying the fields and gardens the Union refugee women and children had planted so laboriously on their small farms. It was Wade's intention to drive every Union refugee family he could find back upon the protection of Fort Gibson, compelling the fort to feed them from the limited stores hauled at such labor by mule and ox trains from far-off Kansas. And Wade did all in his power to keep those trains from getting through. Thus, he hoped to force Phillips to evacuate the fort and return to Kansas, leaving all the Cherokee Nation to the Confederates. It was the duty of the new Union cavalry, of which Jeff was now a part, to prevent these depredations if he could. Jeff's detail was patrolling an area north of Tahlequah late one hot June afternoon, when they saw a cloud of gray and brown smoke rising above the distant oaks. "Ho!" called Jim Pike, the sergeant, pulling his horse to a stop. Scowling, Pike peered hard ahead at the smoke, trying to assess its origin. "Looks like a haystack burning," guessed Sam Sukmeyer, a private. Pike touched spurs to his mount. "Maybe we'd better go see. Might be something else." Riding toward the smoke, they found a small cornfield, and Jeff was dismayed to see a crude wooden drag had been pulled across the crop and the plants jerked out of the ground by the roots. Fresh horse tracks lay plain in the sandy soil. Alarmed, they quickened their pace. Jeff had heard so many first-hand accounts of the rebel depredations that he dreaded what they might find. They found it in the barn lot of a small farm. The troopers pulled up their horses and stared with horror. A fine chestnut mare lay dead, her head in a pool of blood. Her two small colts stood tugging at their lifeless mother's teats. Jeff heard Stuart Mitchell begin to curse, slowly at first, then more loudly and with increasing bitterness. And then he heard something else, something that froze the marrow in his bones. A woman was screaming hysterically somewhere in the smoke ahead. Rapidly they followed the noise. A two-room log dwelling blazed brightly in broad daylight, the red flames crackling fiercely as they consumed the thatched roof. Beneath some cedar trees in the yard, two women and a small boy were huddled like frightened sheep around the body of a man. The older woman, obviously the grandmother, was trying vainly to comfort the mother, while the child crouched nearby, his boyish countenance stiff with shock. The older woman heard them ride into the yard. Raising a white face etched with terror, she drew back as if expecting a blow, one wrinkled hand held over her open mouth. Then she saw their blue coats and realized they were Union. Pike got down from his horse and questioned her. They learned the dead man was Frank Brand, a mixed-blood soldier from the Union Indian Brigade at Fort Gibson who had been given a short furlough to help his family work the corn on their farm. The Wade party had ridden up suddenly, surrounded him, and shot him while his family stood begging for his life. Gently, Noah led the wife to the smokehouse and persuaded her to sit on a log and stop her screaming.
"They came an hour ago,"
the grandmother told them, her voice broken with emotion, her eyes twin pools of horror.
"First, they killed Frank. Then they took all we had to eat, a small midgin of sugar, half a ham, all our flour. They went through the house and took all our blankets, quilts, pillowcases, even the children's shoes. They ripped open our feather beds with their bayonets. They said they was searching for guns. But we knew they was after rings and jewelry to carry back to their families. They went to the barn with their cavalry ropes and stole our cow.
They couldn't take the mare on account of her two small colts born 3-4 day ago. So they shot her. They took every chicken and goose, then they fired the house. I used to love to see the spring come, but now I hate it. I knew the bushwhacking would begin in dead earnest once the leaves came out again.
She stood indecisively, wringing her hands in her apron. His heart in a turmoil, Jeff turned away. Suddenly there was a slight movement ahead, and he discovered a small boy cowering behind a cedar hedge. He held both hands over the stomach of his blouse and looked fearfully at the ground. "What's the matter?" Jeff asked kindly. Shrinking back into the hedge, the boy gripped his stomach so tightly that his hands grew white, but still he wouldn't speak.
"He's scared," piped a childish voice behind Jeff. "The rebel soldiers told him that when the bluecoats come, they'd rip his belly open with their swords."
Aghast, Jeff looked around. The older boy had followed him from the yard.
"Pa's dead,"
the older boy bluntly told the younger.
"The rebels bushwhacked him."
The child stared woodenly, as though he hadn't heard. A wave of pity surged over Jeff. He turned to the older boy. "What's your name?"
"Johnny, can I see your gun?"
"And what's his name?"
"Jackie." "Is your gun a Springfield?" "Pa had a Springfield, but when the rebels bushwhacked him, they tuck it with them."
"Johnny, tell your brother the rebels were lying. We won't hurt him. Tell him to take his hands down." Obediently, Johnny walked over to where his little brother was standing, frozen with fear.
"Take your hands down, Jackie. They won't hurt you."
Jackie shook his head, eyeing Jeff's saber fearfully. He kept his fingers crossed tightly across his stomach. Johnny frowned impatiently. Stooping over until his face was only inches from Jackie's, he said,
"Aw, Jackie, they won't rip your belly open. See here? They didn't hurt mine."
Pulling up his blouse, he bared his own midriff. That seemed to satisfy Jackie. The fear went out of his face. His hands came down. Jeff knelt, holding out his arms. "Come here, Jackie, and I'll show you my horse." Jackie came haltingly. Jeff picked him up. Johnny followed, still chattering brightly about the tragedy that had befallen his family.
"Mama screamed and Pa swore, but they bushwhacked him anyways."
At dusk, the fatherless family was loaded into a wagon and they started back to the fort. Building a rough coffin out of some planks they tore off the barn, the cavalry had buried Frank Brandt beneath a lilac bush in the front yard. Jeff and Noah erected a rude headstone of rocks near the grave. The wagon jolted along over the rough ground, its hubs squeaking.
"What about the two colts?"
Noah asked after they had ridden a quarter of a mile. Pike looked uncomfortable. He pulled back on his reins, stopping his horse. With his big hand, he wiped a gnat off his neck. The wagon lumbered on, accompanied by part of the platoon.
"He's too young to travel or to graze. If we leave him, they'd only starve or the wolves would get him," Pike said.
He looked around hesitantly. They all saw he hated to give the order.
"Oh, cripes, I'll do it,"
growled Seth Wilson, a farmer from Woodson County.
"Give me a couple extra cartridges, somebody."
Silently, Mitchell dug in his cartridge box and handed him three. Jerking his carbine out of its leather sheath, Wilson turned his horse around and rode at a slow trot back toward the lonely barnyard, grumbling to himself. Later, the sound of the two shots caused the wolves back in the hills to set up an unhappy wailing that seemed the consummation of grief and loneliness. When they drove through the fort's big gates 6 hours later, the western moon was sinking over a row of whitewashed blockhouses. Johnny and Jackie Brandt were sound asleep beside their mother. Wide awake, she sat like a post, staring wretchedly into the semi-darkness, trying to plan a new life without a husband or a home. Just before he dozed off in his tent, Jeff thought of Lucy and her brother Lee. He wondered if Lee Washburn had been with a weighty raiding party that had burned the Brant home. He doubted it. Judging Lee by the Washburn womenfolk and by their home, Jeff was sure he hadn't. He wondered whether Lee were high-spirited and proud, like Lucy, or whether he could control his emotions like the other Washburn women. Pulling a light blanket over his shoulders, he thought of what Mrs. Adair had told him of Lucy's devotion to her brother. He wished he could help Lucy find him, but he didn't quite know how to go about it. He resolved to talk to Noah about it in the morning. Chapter 16. The Name on the Watch. Jeff heard the sentries calling off all around the sleeping fort, their sing-song voices bawling dutifully through the darkness.
Number 1, 11 o'clock, all's well.
It was 3 nights after Pike's patrol had brought in the Brant family. Jeff, accompanied by Dixie, was walking sentry along the north shore of the Neosho River below the fort. He stopped for a moment, listening to the Oz Wells. Gruff voices, nasal voices, sleepy voices, bored voices, traveling slowly westward, up the side of the bluff, passing out of hearing behind the distant palisades, then emerging faintly on the far side, and returning, station by station, to the original point of call, girding the darkened fort with a ring of security. It was stiflingly hot. Wearily, Jeff slapped at a mosquito. His uniform, stiff with dirt and dust, chafed and his body smelled of stale sweat. His musket was heavy. Switching it to the opposite shoulder, he wished he could have drawn the duty on top of the bluff where there was a breeze. Although it was an hour before midnight and everything was black as pitch, it seemed to him the night was very much alive. He knew the rebels were very much alive on the south bank of the nearby Arkansas River that divided the two armies. When he had been on outpost duty there the day before, he had heard the voices of their pickets as they met across the river, and seen the faint illumination of their pipes through the shadowy cottonwoods and willows that lined the opposite shore, and smelled the fresh beef broiling over the campfires. The rebels always had twice as much to eat as they did. He thought of Lucy and her dark beauty, and an intolerable longing assailed him. If she could ever forget the war long enough, maybe he could make her like him. A low growl came from Dixie. Crouching, she advanced on the bushes, ears flat, fur bristling. Startled, Jeff wheeled and raised his musket to the ready, remembering how Sparrow had been knifed in the back while on sentry.
Jeff!
The voice came in a half-whisper.
Who's there?
A shadowy figure loomed out of the darkness.
It's me, David Gardner. I've got the duty 2 stations down. Say, Jeff, let's walk over to the other river and talk to the rebel pickets. Want to?
Corn, no, said Jeff, recoiling. It was the craziest idea he'd ever heard.
I'm scared of 'em. Besides, we're not supposed to leave our posts. If the officers caught us, they'd court-martial us.
Nah, they wouldn't, Jeff, David argued.
Besides, the officers in both armies is all asleep. McCoy says he'll walk my beat and his both. John says he'll watch yours. Our outpost pickets, over at the other river, always lets us go through if we give them some of the tobacco we get from the Rebs.
Jeff thought of Pete Milholland and the Brant family.
You can't trust the rebels, Davy. I wouldn't trust one of Wadey's men any further than I can throw an ox by the tail. They'd slit your throat. They're treacherous.
No, they're not, Jeff.
Not when we meet 'em this-a-way,
David insisted with quiet stubbornness.
How do you know? Because we've been meeting 'em every night in the middle of the river and swapping knives and talking to 'em.
Jeff stared at him incredulously, unable to believe his ears. David went on.
Some of their pickets is mean, but I don't think they're weighty men. There won't be any weighty men there. When the mean ones is on sentry, our guys will holler over just to devil 'em and say, "How much is Confederate money worth today?"
and the rebels will sass us right back by asking us if the niggers we're fighting for haven't proved the Yankee breed any yet, and things like that. But mainly, they're pretty good fellers for rebels. Tonight, the good ones is on duty. They promised to bring us some plue tobacco. We're going to swap them some of our coffee for it. Jeff thought it over. It still sounded harebrained to him. What do you talk to him about? Oh, just everything. Girls, rations, officers, the weather. How the common soldiers on each side is the victims in the war. How we'd both stop the war tomorrow and hang all the politicians that got us into it if we was running the show. Jeff laughed in the dark. Which we aren't. But mainly, we just talk about our mothers and our fathers and our sweethearts. Better come with us, Jeff. It's fun. In the dark, Jeff rubbed his thumb along the smooth stock of his musket. Maybe some of the rebels knew Lee Washburn and would volunteer some news that Jeff could pass on to Lucy. He drew a long breath and decided to take the plunge. All right, Davy, I'll go. But I still think it's crazy. Half an hour later, with three other Union pickets, they stole down to the north bank of the Arkansas, stacked their arms carefully on the bank, and peeled out of their clothing. They left one sentry to guard the clothing and stay with Dixie, whom Jeff tied to a willow back away from the shore so she wouldn't bark. Then they walked 100 yards through the warm sand to the water's edge. David cupped his hands around his mouth and called cautiously toward the opposite shore.
Hey, Pork and Molasses, you there?
There was silence. A small sandbank caved with a slight splash into the murmuring current. A bullfrog bellowed sleepily from a swale. Jeff listened, and his breathing quickened as a voice came softly, furtively from the rebel side.
We's here.
One of the Union pickets with David and Jeff called jocularly.
When is Cooper gonna march into Gibson?
When you all get your last mule and dog head up.
Got any tobacco?
Yep. Got any coffee?
Yep. We'll meet you halfway.
Won't shoot?
Nope.
Still suspecting treachery, Jeff stepped gingerly into the warm water. His skin felt goose-pimply.
This was madness. What had he been thinking about, agreeing to do a thing as stupid as this? This was the enemy, the people they'd been fighting against 2 long years.
They waded out a few yards, then stopped to listen. From the darkness ahead came a faint splashing of men wading. Half a dozen naked figures appeared from the opposite bank like ghosts out of the gloom. They met at a shadowy sandbar in the middle of the river and halted, the water dripping noisily off their sleek bodies.
"Hello, Johnny. How are you?"
David said to the nearest one.
"Fine, Yank. How y'all?"
Jeff relaxed a little. It was lighter here in the open, away from the dark trees. Some of the rebels were carrying twists of tobacco, scarce in the north. Some of the Union pickets bore small sacks of coffee beans, dear in the south. After the swap was made, they stacked the bartered goods on the sandbar and, to Jeff's astonishment, went swimming together in midstream. Jeff found himself with a small, wiry rebel who swam like a bullfrog. Cautiously, they began to talk, watching each other like hawks.
"We's Armstrong's men, from Texas. What's your outfit?"
the rebel asked.
"Clardy, 7th Kansas Cavalry," Jeff replied.
The rebels had captured 6 of his company 2 weeks earlier and sent them to a prison at Tyler, Texas, so he knew the information was no secret. The rebel seemed interested.
"Clardy. Seems like I've heard of him."
"I heard he's a rough one."
"You heard right," Jeff frowned in the darkness.
"Say, you know a fella named Lee Washburn? He's with Wadey."
The rebel shook his bushy head in the half-light.
"I don't know him, but wait a minute. Joe, over here, is a weighty man. Maybe he knows him."
Jeff's heart began pounding furiously. David had told him there wouldn't be any weighty men. Quietly, the rebel summoned one of his comrades swimming a short distance away.
Joe, you know somebody named Lee Washburn with weighty?
As Joe bobbed his wet black head up and down, Jeff thought he looked like an otter.
Sure, I know him. But he never come back from a scout 3 weeks ago. Our officers is afraid the Yanks captured him. His father is captain of my company. Colonel Wadey's been trying to get Lee back on a prisoner exchange, but he can't get in touch with the Union commander.
Jeff was disappointed, but at least he had some news for Lucy. Soon it was time to go. The two parties bade each other goodbye and parted, each wading back to its own shore. Jeff had swapped an old St. Louis newspaper for a twist of tobacco for Noah, Bill, and Stuart Mitchell. The swim had cooled him off. To his surprise, he found he had enjoyed the unusual adventure. But as they dressed, he was curious about one thing.
Davy, won't all this visiting and fraternizing make each side want to go easy on the other when they meet in battle?
David snorted.
Nah, if we met in battle tomorrow, we'd still be trying to cut each other's hearts out. This was just a recess.
There was a recess of a different kind on a quiet, moonlight night a week later. They were camped on the north bank of the Arkansas, and the cavalrymen were bored. Lieutenant Foss had entertained them just before sundown with an exhibition of trick riding, hooking one toe around his saddle horn and leaning low to snatch up a handkerchief from the ground while riding full tilt. But they were tired of the usual long jumping contests, the card games, and the tugs of war. Noah was slumped on his stomach by the campfire, reading a new novel by Dickens. Bill Earl had just finished shaving and was wiping the soap off the straight edge he had borrowed from John Chadwick.
Soldier, why don't you sing something?
Clardy, the scar on his left cheek gleaming in the moonlight, had walked out of the shadows and confronted Bill. There was a smirk on the captain's face, as there always was when he tried to look pleasant and failed. He should have addressed Earl as Trooper, but, like all of them, had difficulty adjusting his conversation to cavalry terms. Bill put down the razor and saluted smartly.
Yes, sir. What song would you like to hear, sir?
Clardy waved his hand as though leaving the choice to Bill. The trooper sat up with keen anticipation. Bill could sing, and the fact the captain had asked him to lent additional importance to the occasion. Jeff sat with his back braced against a cottonwood log. Dixie was at his feet. Everybody knew her now. She was the pet of the regiment. The captain's sudden interest in singing didn't dovetail with an incident Jeff remembered from the long, hot march to Wilson's Creek. On that occasion, they had angered Clardy by singing a parody on the rebel tune Dixie, making up their own words as they marched.
I wish I's back in Douglas County, 2 years up, and I had my bounty. Look away, look away, look away to Kansas land. Singing soldiers won't fight,
Clardy had snarled at them. Now Jeff eyed Clardy warily and wondered what lay back of the newfound enthusiasm for music. Earl's tenor, clear and sweet, began the ever-popular John Brown's Body, and on each chorus, the troopers kept time by clapping their hands to the singing. At first, Bill sang mostly what the soldiers asked for, such favorites as Shoe Fly Shoe, Gay and Happy Still, and Wait for the Wagon. But when he began the hauntingly sweet notes of Come Where My Love Lies Dreaming, everything became quiet, and the whole camp seemed to hang upon the song and drink in the emotional impact of the melancholy words. When the last sad strains were over, no one spoke. A stick snapped in the shadow. It was Clardy.
Soldier, can you sing Tramp, Tramp, Tramp?
He asked Earl. Bill sang the song, and at its conclusion, Clardy stared across the river, his body bent forward, listening.
Listen.
From the rebel side of the Arkansas, another voice was heard, a low, powerful baritone that carried strongly across the murmuring water. The rebel singer warmed up on Johnny Fill Up the Bowl, and then swung into Pop Goes the Weasel and Lily Dale. He was accompanied by what sounded like a banjo. In the bright moonlight, Clardy's thin, nervous hands opened and closed spasmodically, and a sneering, triumphant expression crossed his face. Suddenly, the rebel singer lifted his smooth, vibrant voice in the old favorite, Annie Laurie. And then a wonderful thing happened. On the chorus, Bill Earl joined in, singing the harmony. 200 yards apart, the rebel baritone and the Union tenor finished the old Scottish song together, their voices blending in the soft June night. Then Bill began everybody's favorite, Home Sweet Home. Quickly, the rebel singer joined him, and as the homesick men of both armies sang the chorus, Jeff, misty-eyed like the others, thought of his own home and family in far-off Linn County. Later, after they returned to the fort, David stopped him at the water barrel. Looking carefully around, he whispered,
Hey, Jeff, I know who that rebel singer is. His name's Chastine. He's a Texian lawyer from Goliad. The rebel pickets told us about him one night when we were swimming with him. He used to lead a church choir at Santone.
That night, Jeff lay awake, wondering why Clardy, who ordinarily disliked music, had seemed so enthralled with the singing. Why had he asked Bill to sing in the first place? It seemed that Clardy had known what was going to happen. An hour before dawn, Jeff was awakened by a rough hand shaking his shoulder. It was the orderly sergeant growling,
Be dressed in 15 minutes, special duty.
Yawning, Jeff sat up and discovered that the weather had completely reversed itself. The morning was heavily overcast and wild with wind. As he pulled on his boots, he felt singularly depressed. He guessed it was because of the gloomy weather. Special duty, the orderly sergeant had said. Jeff wondered what it was. The wind gushed so hard that he had to drop to his knees before he could stuff his blouse into his pants. Blown sand stung his cheek. The horses stood with their backs to the wind, their manes, tails, and forelocks tousled. As his company was ordered into infantry alignment and began to march, again he had the feeling of dread and foreboding, as though something unpleasant were about to happen. Everything was sodden with moisture. It formed in tiny gray beads on the walnut stock of Jeff's musket. Ahead, the men's feet left darkened trails in the wet grass as they marched to the drill field.
What's up?
Bill whispered, as they did a right oblique.
Where are they taking us?
Don't know, muttered Stewart, but we'll soon find out.
Colonel Phillips was off on a scout, and Clardy, next in rank, was in temporary command at the fort. What was it all about? Finally, after they were formed into a rectangle at one end of the drill field, Noah had it figured.
Must be an execution, he guessed, or they wouldn't be putting us in Hollow Square. Probably some deserter Clardy figures on shooting before Phillips gets back.
The wind howled like a demented giant. It flattened the prairie grass and turned the small oaks so topsy-turvy that they looked like capsized umbrellas. The air smelled of rain. Jeff shuddered. What a desolate morning to have to die. Above the roar of the weather came the thin squeak of a fife, strangely flawed by the wind. It was accompanied by a drum. It was the saddest, dreariest music he had ever heard.
That's the dead march,
growled a grizzled corporal nearby.
There they come,
quavered somebody else. Jeff felt the back of his neck prickling. Marching slowly side by side came the fifer and the drummer, followed by a guard of 12 armed men. Then came 4 troopers carrying a new coffin of cheap yellow pine, and behind them, the condemned man. Bareheaded, he marched stoically, a heavily armed guard on each side of him, a chaplain at his elbow, and last of all, trudged the 10-man firing squad, whose faces revealed plainly their distaste for the job ahead, despite the fact that the musket of one was loaded with a blank charge, and none knew who carried the harmless gun. The grim procession halted. The coffin was placed on the ground beside an open grave. The prisoner, dressed in shirt and trousers of butter knife,